Before I begin, I just wanted to advise the court that His Honor Judge Jones and I went to law school many years ago, and I don't know if that's an issue, but I didn't want to begin without notice to your honors.
Okay, well, I'll let Judge Jones address that.
I do remember that we did. We were in the same class graduating law school. I won't say what year that was.
Okay. So I'll turn to your opposing counsel. Do you have any objections or problems with them going to the same law school at the same time?
No, Your Honor, not unless His Honor Mr. Jones believes that's going to be an issue as far as impartiality. But other than that, I have no cause to believe
it. Very well. Judge Jones is shaking his head no. So
I don't think we've seen each other in many years. And we'll leave it at that.
Very good. With that, then, I think we're ready to proceed.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Richard A. Bavarnik, registration number 15909. I am here today at my client's request to address the misconstruence and misapplication of the workers' compensation law by an administrative law judge. In this particular case, the administrative law judge erred by awarding future medical benefits to which the claimant did not prove by substantial evidence in the record at the time of the hearing he was in fact entitled to. And that is reversible error. The seminal case on point is Grover versus Industrial Commission that was decided back in 1988, written by Chief Justice Quinn. Chief Justice Quinn, in expressing the majority opinion, stated, before an order for future medical benefits may be entered, there must be substantial evidence in the record to support a determination that future medical treatment will be necessary to relieve the injured worker from the effects of the work-related injury. At issue before you is the ALJ's award of two specific and detailed benefits. The first, household help services and attendant care that he enunciated specifically by line item. Second, transportation in the form of a wheelchair accessible van. Household and attendant care services. The administrative law judge ordered the school district to pay for the cost of all household services and attendant care recommended by the authorized treating physician, Dr. Ridings. He then awarded cleaning, dusting, cooking, laundry, vacuuming, changing of linens, assistance with transfers, bathing, dressing, and quote, other attendant care. The error is that Dr. Ridings did not prescribe what the judge awarded for future care. In fact, what Dr. Ridings said was an evaluation was necessary in order to determine what, if any, future care the claimant required. And it's important to note that the hearing occurred on May 15, and the claimant 10 days thereafter, as the record demonstrates, relocated from Colorado Springs to Missoula, Montana. And there was no credible evidence submitted by the claimant whose burden of proof it was to establish entitlement to said attendant care that any of this was reasonably needed to relieve from the effects of the injury in Missoula, Montana. And that was the claimant's burden to which he failed to present any credible evidence. Now, what we know is that pursuant to Grover, without substantial evidence, this court has the absolute authority to reverse the award of benefits, even though the agency determining the issue found in claimant's favor, even though the intermediate appellate body affirmed the order. In this case, given the evidence presented to the administrative law judge, at most, his award could have been an evaluation, Once the evaluation occurred pursuant to Grover, the school district retained its right to challenge the reasonableness and necessity. But this judge didn't do that. This judge awarded the litany of home health care that I reflected earlier. And as a result, my client, the school district, was left without recourse. Now, what the judge did was circumvented their rights by awarding all of this care. And we don't know whether or not any or all of it is reasonable or necessary to relieve from the effects of the injury because no evaluation of where he was moving to had taken place.
So is your primary argument on this issue that the move to Montana made null and void all the determinations about the household tasks that he wasn't able to do?
In part. In part, it didn't matter whether he moved or not because what Dr. Ridings prescribed was an evaluation in his home to determine what he did or didn't need. And once that evaluation took place, and then Dr. Ridings could make his ultimate opinion, my client still has the absolute right under Grover to challenge the reasonableness or necessity of what, after the evaluation, Dr. Ridings prescribed. But because the claimant, 10 days thereafter the hearing, was relocating to Montana, and there was no credible evidence as to the effect of moving up to Montana to be with his son would have with regard to the need for the attendant care, his order was unsupported by substantial evidence because it's an award of future medical care. But you still need substantial evidence for the need in the future. And we don't know what that would have been. That is the problem. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Bavarnik, I'm going back through your opening brief, and I'm trying to find out where this argument that you're now making was raised. I'm looking at the argument dealing with the van, and it all has to do with whether the van provides therapeutic relief. That's the only argument in here. There's no argument about, well, he moved to Montana, so we don't know what the conditions in Montana were. This was only a recommended evaluation. I'm just looking and I'm just not seeing it.
Okay. And first I'll turn your attention to the reply brief.
All right, well,
how about
the opening brief?
Right.
Is it in the opening brief?
And now I need to flip back to the opening brief. And I would turn your attention with regard to the issues presented initially, page 25, with regard to first the litany of what was ordered, and I turn your attention to page 33, Your Honor, right above the conclusion. And there's a brief statement with regard to relocation to Missoula, Montana. And then just recognizing that a benefit cannot be awarded based on speculation, conjecture, or surmise. So I do acknowledge that it was not as artfully worded, perhaps, and not as detailed, but between the opening brief there as well as the reply brief, it was discussed. And I think it is relevant material with regard to the issue before you. Now, what the district is requesting is you set aside the judge's gratuitous provision of all of the care, cleaning, dusting, cooking, laundry, vacuuming, changing linens, etc. Because, one, we don't know. But two, and more importantly, there was not substantial evidence that that was going to be needed in the future. And without that, pursuant to Grover, the judge was without legal authority to award those benefits. Second, in our opinion, it was error to award the wheelchair accessible van. The legal question is whether or not the wheelchair accessible van provided therapeutic relief. As Judge Casebolt stated in Vogue versus SDI, for a pertinent apparatus to be considered a medical benefit under the statute, it must be a medical apparatus that is reasonably necessary for treatment of the injury or that provides therapeutic relief from the effects of the injury. Judge Casebolt noted the terms relief from the effects of the injury and therapeutic relief have been narrowly construed, citing Cheyenne County Nursing Home. As in Bose, here, a wheelchair accessible van was not a medical apparatus reasonably necessary for treatment of the injury, because the van in and of itself does nothing in this case to cure or remedy claimant's injury, nor did it provide therapeutic relief. The inference that Judge Felter drew was that, well, you've got to get in your wheelchair to healthcare, and so therefore you need a mode of transportation. And again, the problem is that there was no credible evidence that future medical care, claimant's burden to prove, where he was moving to, required a wheelchair accessible van. So we would respectfully request that that too be set aside, and I will reserve my 4 minutes.
Would there be?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there anything in the record that would suggest that there was a different condition in Montana so that he wouldn't need the wheelchair or the van to make it accessible to get to
the claimant,
medical help?
I beg your pardon for interrupting. Sorry. The claimant, whose burden of proof it is to prove entitlement to medical benefits, did not submit credible evidence that Montana required a wheelchair accessible van. The claimant was silent on this point. The only information that the claimant put forth was that in Colorado Springs, there was a time delay, allegedly, with Silver Key, the one time he used it. That's the only evidence in the record, but there was nothing to support an award of future medical care because the claimant did not address that. And I now have 3 minutes left.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Jason Landris, and I represent the claimant appellee, Mr. Jeffrey Hoberg. My bar registration number is 40956. Your Honor, it's well established in workers' compensation jurisprudence that the determination of whether a medical benefit is compensable is an issue of fact, a question of fact, to be determined by the ALJ. As such, the standard of review in this case is clearly erroneous. In this case, ALJ Felter, in a 26-page order, cited a volume of substantial evidence to support his findings of fact and conclusions of law. Furthermore, in that 26-page order, he cited to all relevant case law on the issues surrounding compensability of medical benefits within the confines of a conversion van or wheelchair accessible van, which is often used interchangeably, and household services and household care or attended care services.
Counsel, in Bogue, The division did not permit a wheelchair-accessible van as a medical benefit. Can you discuss that case for me, please?
Absolutely, Your Honor. In Vogue, as the court is probably familiar, this was a situation where the claimant was requesting a wheelchair conversion van because he had to wait outside for a bus. Essentially, he was able to utilize his electric wheelchair or his wheelchair, but once he would get outside, at times, inclement weather would occur. Based on the fact that there was no credible or substantial evidence provided by the claimant that being able to use a conversion van and remain out of inclement weather would relieve the symptoms or affects of the industrial injury and or prevent deterioration of that injury over time.
And what would be the difference in the facts of this case then?
Good question, Your Honor. Something fundamental to understand about Mr. Hoberg is what Dr. Ridings, Ms. Catchell, and himself repeatedly testify to, which is that any movement, any physical activity that Mr. Hoberg has to engage in causes him increased pain. Therefore, it follows, Your Honor, that if he's able to use his conversion van, which allows him to minimize the amount of physical exertion that he has to exercise, that actually relieves his pain. It doesn't simply, as in Bo, give him peace of mind and the ability to stay out of the rain. It actually has a tangible effect on relieving his pain. Furthermore, there's evidence that as his treatment progressed, as Mr. Hoberg was out of the emergency room and continued through treatment, his condition continued to deteriorate over time with use and ambulation of a walker. Ms. Catchell did an evaluation which stated that his use of a walker actually increased his pain, put him at risk of future injury, and because he has an analtegic gait, actually prevents the four-pronged walker from maintaining all four points of contact on the ground. This is critical because the nature of his injuries will not handle well a fall. It would seriously increase an already permanently and totally disabled individual's pain and degree of injury. So when we look at Vogue, Vogue doesn't nearly have the evidence as to what effect it will have in therapeutically relieving the injuries of the claimant, nor does it have evidence to prevent deterioration and degradation of the injury or access medical care. In Vogue, the claimant was able to access medical care. He just wanted to be able to sit outside the rain. I think the better case to analogize, as cited in my brief, is the Gregory Harrison case. In Harrison, we've got a very similar factual circumstance to the one in Mr. Hoberg's case. We've got an individual who's confined with incomplete paraplegia. And I know the court's familiar with the record, so it's familiar with the limitations and physical constraints that Mr. Hoberg has. While not paralyzed, many of his deficiencies are similar to those of the deficiencies that other people who are confined to a wheelchair experience. In Harrison, the claimant was forced to go out to essentially travel to his Ford Explorer, lift his wheelchair into his Ford Explorer, then travel to his medical care, remove the wheelchair from his Ford Explorer, and then he was able to use it again. In that case, substantial evidence was provided by the claimant to show that the process that Mr. Harrison was going through, namely traveling to his vehicle, having to transfer into his vehicle, move the wheelchair in, etc., and repeat that numerous times, was actually causing additional pain and additional injuries. It was weakening his shoulder, it was causing skin deterioration issues. When we look at the facts of this case, Mr. Hoberg, as confirmed through Dr. Ryden's testimony and Ms. Catchell's testimony, has a very limited ability to utilize a walker. He had to travel approximately 60 feet from his apartment to his vehicle. He had a Chevy Trailblazer, which is extremely similar to a Ford Explorer, had to transfer himself into the vehicle after securing his walker, had to ride in the vehicle in a seat that's not designed for his particular kyphosis and his injuries, which caused him additional pains even though he was sitting there. Then he would arrive, have to get out, which would cause him pain because any physical exertion causes him pain, secure his walker, ambulate in with the walker, sit in a lobby that's not, with chairs that aren't designed for him, and all along the way, there's evidence that his pain was increasing all the way along. And that over time, despite physical activity, despite using a walker, the narcotic remediation of his pain wasn't decreasing. His ability to ambulate with a walker, the distances weren't increasing. The narcotic remediation was increasing in the sense that more OxyContin was necessary over time than less. Furthermore, the distances that he was able to travel safely with a walker became shorter and shorter over time. What's really telling, I think, more than anything, and gives a glimpse as to the positive therapeutic relief that that a conversion ban in this case would afford, is the visit that he has with Dr. Ridings, when Dr. Ridings is able to see how well he is tolerating sitting in his electric wheelchair, how comfortable he looks, that he's not sweating, that he's not shaking, that he's not trembling, that he doesn't have a quivering voice, that he's not displaying any outward signs of the pain that he shows when he ambulates with a walker. He also notes that there was no need to change the medication protocol that day. I think that's very telling and further differentiate this case from that of both. With regard to the standard of review in this case, being that it's clearly erroneous, and because the court relied on substantial evidence that exists in the record, this court cannot disrupt the ALJ's findings. When an ALJ relies on substantial evidence in the record, he is the one charged with findings of fact. And I think the Supreme Court of Colorado said it best when it said, it is axiomatic that an appellate court cannot substitute itself as a finder of fact, and that factual findings of the lower court sitting without a jury are not to be disturbed on appeal unless clearly erroneous and not supported by the record.
Well, as I understood your counterpart with regard to the household activities, that there was not a sufficient record, that there was not an evaluation on how it would affect the move to Montana. Can you address that?
Yes, I'm glad the court brought that up. Two things. One, again, the fundamental understanding of Mr. Hoberg's injuries and pain and what he struggles with is movement. It's not weather, it's not the state that he lives in, it's not dependent on humidity, cold temperature, warm temperature. It's physical movement. Bending, standing on his own without assistance, transferring in and out of a bathtub, dressing, those type of things. Dr. Ridings is quoted as saying that the claimant is significantly limited, and this is in the record, page 81, lines 12 through 14. Claimant is significantly limited in his ability to perform any household ADLs, activities of daily living, as getting up and down to a walker causes significantly increased pain and fatigue.
Doesn't he simply prescribe the evaluation, though, rather than an entitlement at that point to all of these different household?
That's a good question, aids. Your Honor. And if we look at the case law that talks about the standard of review, it also talks about that the reviewing court must allow all plausible inferences of the court below to stand, so long as they are substantially supported in the record. And it logically follows, and it's certainly a plausible inference, that if any movement by Mr. Hoberg causes him pain, that he is not going to get up and dust the fan, he is not going to be able to cook himself meals, that he is not going to bathe himself, and all of this is documented in different places. It's documented in testimony from the claimant himself. It's documented in part by Dr. Ridings, who says that claimant will not be performing household chores, whether he has home health aid or not, because he cannot. His house will simply go unclean. So all ALJ Felter does is define any household ADS. It's certainly not an astronomical leap for him to determine that household ADLs are changing linens, cooking meals, dusting, vacuuming. Mr. Hober can't engage in these activities. So in that sense, the evaluation is only necessary if it would be necessary to create a plausible inference on which the court could rely. But that's not the case here. Other evidence is able to confirm that any household ADLs includes all those things. It's axiomatic that any household ADL, activity of daily living or cleaning, would encapsulate those things. So in that sense, there is a volume of substantial evidence when looking at the specific facts of this case and the specific nature of his injuries that shows that under any standard that currently exists, although the less restrictive standard under Bayonne currently exists, Mr. Hobart is entitled to these household services. And because this is an issue of fact, the court cannot interject itself and determine conflicts in the evidence in the ALJ stead. And the ALJ has to be credited with all plausible inferences. And in this case, it is not a stretch to say that those specific and articulated care needs are reasonable and necessary as a medical benefit under CRS 849-101-1A. What the appellant is asking the court to do throughout his brief is go back and re-review all the other evidence that was present. From their witness, for instance, who said something contradictory to our witnesses. Even though I might add, and I think it's important to add, that her initial answer to the question of whether or not providing a conversion ban for Mr. Hoberg was treatment, her answer was yes, and stated unequivocally that he would have to have a means by which to transport his wheelchair. The court can simply not do that in this case because there is a volume of substantial evidence which supports all of the ALJ's findings. When you look at Carlson, the case Carlson, Harrison, and frankly, if we look at Bo, I honestly believe that based on the current jurisprudence in this area, had the Bo court been confronted with injuries similar to that of Mr. Hobart, they would have decided very differently. This isn't a stair glide case. And this isn't a weather case. It's not based on contingencies. He lives this every single day. In the court upholding the ALJ's orders, it will not only be satisfying the standard of review, not only be making the right decision, but it'll allow for the claimant to avoid what ALJ Felter describes as a cruel and unusual way of having to ambulate and access medical care and treatment, and go through daily life. In so doing, this court will do what the respondent has not done, which is provide Mr. Hoberg a modicum of human dignity. And in so doing, it will also make a ruling consistent, as did ALJ Felter, with all of the present medical benefit jurisprudence. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, counsel.
The issue in this case is, did Judge Felter misapply the law? He did. He misapplied the law because he made a leap, to use counsel's word, to provide an order that my client paid for benefits which the claimant didn't prove a future medical need by substantial evidence. He didn't prove a therapeutic need for dusting, for vacuuming, etc. There was no credible evidence on that point. Judge Felter was without authority to order my client to pay for benefits to which the claimant didn't prove the required therapeutic need. Bogue is the seminal case on point. In Bogue, the claimant complained of
without the need of a van, he would feel worse, i.e. increased discomfort. According to a panel of this court, that evidence in and of itself does not provide evidence to award a van. Carlson is at odds, or Harrison, excuse me, is at odds with this case, because Harrison actually established skin breakdown. He had medical evidence of deterioration. That is not in this case. All the claimant has is he says he hurts. Recall, the claimant spends 15 to 18 hours in bed. Recall, the evidence was from Ms. Catchell herself, he wanted a wheelchair-accessible van so he could go fishing. Respondents are not liable to provide the claimant access to a fishing hole.
Counsel, when I read the Bogue case, I noted that they had also talked about the Atencio case, and they did so by saying cases dealing with benefits that are incident to medically necessary services are in a positive here. Why don't we have an Atencio-type situation in this case?
Because we don't have credible evidence that establishes that claimant required, in order to get to health care, the wheelchair-accessible van. All we had was Silver Key in Colorado Springs and nothing in Montana. And pursuant to Grover, the judge was awarding future medical care when he knew 10 days after the hearing, the claimant was moving to Montana. When the claimant asked for the hearing expedited because he knew he was moving 10 days after the hearing to Montana, it was the claimant's burden to prove, and he failed on that point. So we're not asking you to reweigh the evidence. What we're asking you to do is to evaluate the evidence in light of the legal standard. Judge Felter fell well short of the legal standard. And my time is up. If you have any other questions, Your Honors, then I stand and thank you for your time.
I thank you both for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.